sehr auf Yannis Varoufakis.
It is a great privilege and an infinite almost joy to be in such an illustrious meeting today. Thank you, Joachim, thank you, Renate, for the invitation. Thank you, everyone. These are indeed stressful times, Joachim, aren't they? There's a lot of fear and loathing and a lot of uncertainty and angst. It might seem to some of you, I hope not for long, that I'm a very curious choice for settling your nerves by delivering this speech, but I hope to convince you otherwise. When people said to me over the years that a proper United States of Europe is very difficult because we are very different people, the Greeks and the Germans and the Slovaks and the Brits and the French, I always said to them, go and live in Texas for a year or two. Just do that. And suddenly you realize how much we Europeans have in common. Speaking of Texas, I was trying to work out, as I was walking in here, is there anyone really that is not extremely angry and problematic as a person who is happy with what has happened in the United States over the last week? And the only person I could come up with is a Texan, George W. Bush, who can start looking presidential for the first time in his life. Come to think of it, since the financial crisis erupted in 2008, we Europeans have been trying to do our best to make American democracy and economic crisis management look good. Now the Americans have returned the favor in a spirit of reciprocity, trying to make us look good through their interesting choice of president-elect. Now, joking aside, we Europeans have no right to criticize the Americans, because since the crisis of 2008, and especially the euro crisis in 2010, we have been working feverishly, unwittingly, but feverishly, to breed our own Trumps, our own populism, our own sense of discontent, and our own centrifugal forces within Europe. Trump's election symbolizes the demise of an era, a very important, remarkable era, whose illusions have now become exhausted on both sides of the Atlantic. What is important is that that era that now has ended is also the era that made the European Union, as we know it, possible and sustainable. The European Union is no longer sustainable on the basis of the assumptions that we were taking for granted until today. The European Union cannot continue on the basis of business as usual, and there is a reason for that. Because the European Union was founded, despite what we Europeans tell each other to make each other feel good, it was primarily a United States, Washington DC source design in the late 1940s. And it was implemented to a very large extent along the lines of a global plan that was first inspired in Washington, D.C. Of course, we Europeans, after the Second World War, had a great eagerness to unite, to set behind us conflict, war, misery, and discontent. And we jumped at the opportunity. But make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, the European Union we have could not have existed without the United States of America. And I'm not talking just about NATO and creating the peace and the space in which the European Union would be developing and evolving. I'm talking about its economic design. Not so much its political design, but its economic design. The point I shall be making in the remainder of this talk that you so kindly invited me to give, is that we need a fundamental change of direction. It is not a technical problem. There will have to be technical solutions that we haven't tried before. But the problem that we're facing as Europeans is our political coordination failure throughout Europe. And I shall be making the point that we need a fundamental, radical change, a purely political one, that requires leadership. And leadership can only come from Germany. And since the political terrain has more or less imploded, and there is no one left standing in politics throughout Europe other than Angela Merkel, I shall be making the point that this is Angela Merkel's last chance to save Europe. And that will be encouraging you to agree with me that we should give her both guidance and a chance to bring it about. I know this sounds strange from the former finance minister of the radical left party in Greece, but this is how deep the crisis is, that you need a Greek left-winger to promote Angela Merkel. Allow me a trip into history, into economic history, to describe my understanding of what's wrong with Europe and, indeed, with global capitalism. The golden era of capitalism took place between an event in Stuttgart in 1946. It was the speech of hope by Secretary Burns, which signaled the end of deindustrializing Germany, the beginning of reindustrialization and rehabilitation of Germany, and which ended in September, or maybe October 2008. I don't need to explain more what happened then. If you think about it, this period comprises two sub-periods. One between Bretton Woods, the initiation of the Bretton Woods system, Marshall Plan, and so on, and 15th of August 1971, the demise of Bretton Woods with a Nixon shock, which effectively constituted what I call, this is my term, Eurexit. You know what Grexit is. It's when Greece is thrown out by Wolfgang Schäuble from the Euro. Eurexit happened on the 15th of August 1971, which is when Nixon threw all of us out of the dollar zone. That was the end of the dollar-backed Bretton Woods fixed exchange rate regime. That was one period. During that period, a remarkable achievement marks that era. We have fixed exchange rates, the complete sidelining of the world of finance. Banks were boring, as they should be. The emphasis was on investment. The emphasis was on reducing inequality with low inflation and minuscule unemployment on the basis of predictability of exchange rates, fixed exchange rates more or less, and a system of recycling global surpluses. In 1944, 46, 50, 51, 55, the only country that really had a surplus was the United States of America. And they understood that the problem with the gold exchange standard of the 1920s, which yielded 1929 and all the trials and tribulations of humanity after that, was that you cannot fix exchange rates without surplus recycling. If you just fix exchange rates, you create very quick, large capital flows that create bubbles in the deficit regions, which then explode or implode, to be precise, and then the burden of adjustment falls on the deficit countries that are ill-prepared to adjust. Does this remind you of anything? I hope it does. This was the 1930s, but it is also the period since 2008 in Europe. The Americans, in particular the New Dealers in power since 1933, understood that if you're going to fix exchange rates, you have to have a way of centrally managing the flows of surpluses during the good times and during the bad times. Firstly, to prevent the buildup of bubbles during the good times, and secondly, to manage any crisis when a crisis happens. And that was Bretton Woods. America was recycling surpluses. The Marshall Plan is just one example, not the only example, to stabilize the fixed exchange regime that it was creating. That is rational hegemony. Unfortunately, that system could not survive. And it couldn't survive because from 1965, 1966 onwards, Herr Schmucker knew very well, and after that, Willy Brandt and Giscard d'Estaing, America lost its surpluses. So So a system predicated upon the recycling of American surpluses could no longer continue. The Americans are really very good at knowing when to call a day a day. It was the Americans themselves that blew up their own system when they realized it was no longer sustainable, because they understood that they had lost the surpluses. In 1971, a person that I hold in very high esteem, again, this is very weird for a Greek left-winger, who goes by the name of Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker, you'll recall, he was the man in the Fed that pushed interest rates to 20% in the late 70s, early 80s. In 1971, he was an unknown former Democrat that was in, had joined the Nixon administration, advising the former Democrat treasurer at the time, Secretary of the Treasury, John Connolly, another Texan. I have a thing about Texas. And he was asked by Henry Kissinger a simple question, 1971, as an advisor. Kissinger at the time was not in the State Department, he was the National Security Advisor. And the question was, how can we maintain our global dominance, the United States, hegemony, now that we are becoming a deficit country? Now, if Paul Volcker were German, he would say we need to tighten our belt and reduce our deficits. Paul Volcker's reaction, and I have this handwritten memo, it's beautiful, was, well, to remain hegemonic worldwide, what matters is that you recycle surpluses. It doesn't matter whose surpluses you recycle. We have lost our surplus. We have now to recycle other people's surpluses. Come to think of it, the second phase of global capitalism after the Second World War, which began around then with the oil crisis, 71, 72, 73 onwards, with Paul Volcker moving from the New York Federal Reserve to the chair of the Fed in the late 1970s. What we have is a remarkable reversal of the Bretton Woods system. In the Bretton Woods system, we had fixed exchange rates, and we had the United States surplus being recycled to Europe and to Japan, primarily, providing the stability that the European Union, the European Common Market at the time, needed in order to create its own miracle here, but a miracle which was completely predicated upon the global design that the United States implemented and managed on our behalf. They provided us with a fixed exchange rate, which were essential for the steel and coal cartel, the first incarnation of the European Common Market, and then later for the Common Market. Remember, if you don't have fixed exchange rates, it's very difficult for heavy industry in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Northern Italy, to find the modus vivendi to manipulate prices the way they did in order to stop competition between them and to affect the kind of economic foundation on which Brussels was built. That's why I'm saying that without the United States, we could not have built the European Union the way we did. But then the Americans blew this up. Remember, John Connolly came to Europe. He actually came to Bonn as well with a very difficult, harsh Texan message. The dollar is our currency, but it is your problem from now on. And Europeans started thinking, my goodness, and this is what Helmut Schmidt and Giscard d'Estaing did in 1978 in Aachen, when they go together and they created the European monetary system, at the thought that, well, now that we don't have fixed exchange rates, provided and managed by the Americans, we need to do it ourselves. And they did. It's a European monetary system, which failed, and then it was the European exchange rate mechanism, which failed, and then it was the euro that plays that role. But we missed out a lesson, an important lesson that the Americans knew. Fixing exchange rates without surplus recycling leads to 1929. And lo and behold, it did. But once more, let's compare the two post-war periods, because it's essential to understand our predicament through that prism. Before 71, American surpluses were recycled by the United States government through various mechanisms in Europe and Japan, stabilizing Japan, allowing for the Japanese miracle, the German miracle, the European Common Market miracle to happen. This was blown up afterwards. And a new equilibrium was established, which was turned on its head. The United States economy, under the tutelage of people like Paul Volcker, then Alan Greenspan, and so on, operated like a huge vacuum cleaner that was sucking into its territory the net exports of Germany, of the Netherlands, of the rest of Europe, of Japan, of the oil exporters, as well as of China increasingly after the 1990s. The American deficit was increasing, not by accident, but by design. And it was providing the requisite aggregate demand to Germany, to the Netherlands, to Japan, to China, to all exporting, net exporters. And how were the Americans paying for this increasing deficit? Well, by creating circumstances in Wall Street, so profits, 70% of profits from Europe, Japan, and China, that were made as a result of the trade deficit of the United States in the end, were going back to Wall Street to close the loop. This was a system of what I consider to be a balanced, unstable, dynamic equilibrium. It's balanced to the extent that the loop closes. It is an equilibrium to the extent that it created the great moderation. Remember Bernanke's illusory concept? But it is also very unstable because it depends on increasing deficits, burgeoning deficits of the United States, and increasing capital imbalances flows into Wall Street. The problem with that was, as it turned out, that what do Wall Street bankers do if you give them $5 billion net a day to play with? They financialize it. The removal of all the regulatory constraints, affected primarily by the Democrats, people like my friend Larry Summers and somebody who's not my friend, Tim Geithner, back in the 90s, and Rubin, the dismantling of all regulations, allowing the bankers to do whatever they wanted to do, was essential, given that the banks of Wall Street were playing that pivotal role of closing the loop. You can't, on the one hand, expect Wall Street to attract 70% of the rest of the world's profits without deregulating them. But when you deregulate them, they build pyramids of private phony money on top of these streams. And when those pyramids collapse, as they always do, children know that, they go to the beach, try to create a sand pile, they keep adding sand to it, at some point it collapses. This is what happened in 2008, in my simple mind. The tragedy of 2008 was not so much that the financial sector collapsed and then the banks were bailed out. But no, the tragedy is that this surplus recycling mechanism that characterized the world we live in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, which provided the foundation for the Eurozone to be built, the assumptions on which the Maastricht Treaty was created, that mechanism broke down. After 2008, very soon, due to quantitative easing and so on, the American trade deficit started growing again. But it was not capable of providing net exporters with the demand that it was providing before, and Wall Street no longer played the role of recycling the world's profits in a way that could keep aggregate demand at an international level, at the level necessary to keep investment to the same level of savings. In Europe, in the meantime, we had created a fixed exchange rate regime without surplus recycling, exactly like the gold exchange standard of the 1920s, which was doing really very well as long as the American recycling scheme in the global economy was working. Well, then that broke down, our gold standard, also known as the Eurozone, was no longer sustainable. And what did we do after that? We entered a period of deep denial. Let me speak about Greece very, very briefly, not because Greece matters, or actually Greece matters, but it shouldn't matter. In a well-functioning Europe, Greece should be insignificant. The fact that Greece has been in the headlines for so long Imagine if the great state of Delaware was threatening the stability of the United States for 8 years. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that in that case there would be something the matter, not with the state of Delaware, but with the United States of America. But let me give you two examples, nothing you don't know, but I think it's the point in my lecture, in my speech, to bring it out. Two examples of the folly of our political class in Germany, in Greece, in Spain, in France, everywhere. And Greece is a good example. So what happened was that due to the financial crisis from 2008 onwards, as a result of the implosion of this global recycling mechanism, the flimsiest part of the Eurozone of our fixed exchange rate regime collapsed. Greece. The Greek state went bankrupt. So, and how did we deal with this bankruptcy? By pretending it didn't happen. This is how. The European Union, in its infinite wisdom, aided and abetted by the International Monetary Fund, in particularly the French leadership of it. Oops, shouldn't say anything wrong about the French in Germany. Decided to give to the Greek government, the bankrupt Greek government, the largest loan in history ever, not in relative terms, in absolute terms, on conditions of austerity which would, with mathematical precision, shrink Greece's income. Now, you're business people. If I were one of your borrowers, let's say that you had lent me money, let's say you had lent me 10 million some time ago, and my business was not doing well. Let's say I'm Samsung and my phone explodes, whatever, and I lose my customers, right? And I have a difficulty repaying you, not because I have a liquidity problem, but because I have a solvency problem, in the sense that my total assets are not worth as much as my debts to you. And I were to come to you and to say to you, look, I have an idea how I'm going to deal with this problem. Give me another 10 million from which I will repay you the previous 10 million. Or 20 million for that matter. Or 30. Would you give it to me? And imagine now the far-fetched scenario where not only do you give it to me, but you said to me, I will give it to you on condition that you shrink your income further. This is exactly what happened with Greece. The idea of internal devaluation in a fixed exchange rate regime is not a bad one on one condition. It's not a bad one because if you don't have a currency to devalue, you might as well devalue your prices and your wages. Yeah, same thing. Then you regain competitiveness. But there is one condition for that work, ladies and gentlemen. You shouldn't have debt. Because if you have debt, the debt doesn't get devalued. Internal devaluation shrinks prices, shrinks wages, but it doesn't shrink the debt. The debt still has to be paid in euros. So when incomes fall, and you have a government like the Greek one, which is insolvent, it will never be able to repay its debt if you give it more loans on conditions of shrinking its income. Now, didn't they know that? Of course they knew that. They never expected your money to be returned when they gave it to Greece. The only reason why I became prominent, you know what it was? Two reasons. Firstly, because the second one was because I resigned, you know the story. But the first one you probably don't know. Because I wrote an article in January 2010, an open letter to the Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou at the time, who was a friend, in which I was imploring him, pleading with him, not to try to cover up the bankruptcy of the Greek state by borrowing money from Germany and the rest of Europe. And I was saying in this article, if you do this, we are going to enter a 30-year period of a Great Depression. We are going to be despised by the Germans, by the French, the Slovaks, and the Portuguese. And it's going to give rise to a lost generation. And what the only thing that will happen out of this Great Depression is we're going to have fascists in parliament, as we do in Greece. The third largest party is... actually, they're not fascists, they're Nazis. And they're not neo-Nazis. There's nothing neo or reconstructed about them. So why did they do it? Really, very simple. It was a botched attempt to bolster the French and German banks that had a very large hole, black hole. It would have if the French and German banks had not been made whole in 2010, my estimation, and I can show you my figures, is that there would be a need for a bailout of them to the tune of about 10,000 euros per inhabitant of Germany and France. This is why it happened. And my point is that when you have insolvencies of states and banks, what you should do is rationally deal with them, resolve them, restructure them, deal with the bankruptcy of the Greek state as a bankruptcy, not as an illiquidity problem that can go away by means of further loans. Anyway, the result of extending and pretending the bankruptcy of the Greek state and doing the same thing with Portugal, with Italian banks, with Spanish banks, with Irish banks, and so on and so forth, is that now we are in a state of disintegration, of European disintegration. Because the policies that were implemented in order to cover up for this cynical shift of banking losses onto the books of our governments and our taxpayers has been a combination of a great depression in places like Portugal, Greece, and so on, and a great deflation in Germany. The reason why you have, and Wolfgang Schäuble was right when a few weeks ago he blamed the negative interest rates of Mario Draghi for the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland. He was right on this. But he is shooting the messenger. The negative interest rates of the central bank are the messenger. The cause is the fact that we have the highest level of savings in Europe and the lowest level of investment. When you have this disconnect between supply and demand, supply so high and demand is so low of money, you end up with a price that is falling. And the price of money is the rate of interest. And the rate of interest going in negative territory is destroying your pension funds. It is making the Schwabian housewife feel that she's being shortchanged. And then she hates Merkel, even though Merkel invoked her in that famous Stuttgart speech in 2009. And she hates the Greeks hate the Germans, everybody hates the French, and the whole thing is disintegrated. And then when economics implodes and politics follows, as a result of this generalized discontent, we start losing the capacity to debate. Allow me to speak personally just for 1 second. Now, I always consider myself to be a friend of Germany. If you read anything that I've written, ever written or said about Germany, especially addressing my fellow Greeks, was don't blame the Germans. Any sentence beginning with the Germans is wrong, whatever the rest of the sentence is. There's no such thing as the Germans. This is almost Monty Python for those of you who know about English comedy. We're all individuals in the end. There are as many differences between Germans as there are between Germans and Greeks. And indeed, my worst critics are not Germans, they're Greeks. And some of my greatest supporters are not Greeks, they're Germans. So to begin any sentence with "the Greeks are like this," this is the beginning of a very slippery slope that leads to generalization, stereotyping, and in the end, racism. So let's just stop doing this. And yet, here in this country, and in my own country, I was presented as anti-German. And that nothing gave me more pain than that. I'm a staunch Europeanist. I'm a federalist. I want the United States of Europe to happen yesterday, and yet I was portrayed as an anti-European communist. I was portrayed as a populist, even though, in my pre-election speeches in 2015, I was telling the crowds that came to listen to me that the only thing I can promise you is blood, sweat, and tears. That you will not hear any promise from me regarding pay rises, pension rights, or anything that we cannot deliver when our country is bankrupt. That all I promise you is that I will go to the Eurogroup if elected, and I'm going to say to my colleagues there that we must stop this cycle of subterfuge, of pretending and extending. I'm not going to take any more money from the German, the Slovak, the Portuguese taxpayer until and unless our economy is restructured and so is our debt. Because as a bankrupt entity, and I scandalized many people, including Mario Draghi, who lambasted me for this, by saying that I am the finance minister of a bankrupt government, as I think I had a moral obligation to say. In saying this, I was trying to make the point that I did not have the right to take your money in order to keep pretending to Greeks and Germans and the French and so on that Greece has been solved when it hasn't been solved. That was the only promise I made. And yet I was presented as a populist. In the 5.5 months I was in the ministry, I didn't do much because I wasn't given an opportunity to do much. But the one thing I made sure I didn't do was I didn't give any pay rises. I actually reduced the expenditure of the state and increased the tax take. I left a primary surplus when I left, and I even managed to pay 7 billion back to creditors. And yet that was described in the press as populism. Now that gives populists a very, very good name, I'm afraid. Let me relate to you the experience in the Eurogroup in Brussels. The worst thing that happens when economics and politics implode is we end up with an Orwellian bureaucracy. Remember George Orwell's doublespeak? I believe that anyone who goes to Brussels these days must be equipped with a Eurospeak dictionary so that they can understand what they're being told. I was making proposals for reducing VAT, value-added tax, corporate tax rates, and income taxes. And the IMF, the Commission, and the European Central Bank didn't want to hear. And what was leaked to the press? That I was refusing reforms. I was bringing with me proposals put together, co-authored with people like Larry Summers, whom I criticized a minute ago, the former US Treasury Secretary, Thomas Mayer, who used to be the chief economist of Deutsche Bank, Lord Norman Lamont, who was John Major's Chancellor of the Exchequer, not exactly a left-winger, and various other, Jeff Sachs of Columbia University, on how to restructure the Greek debt in a way that wouldn't bring a haircut on the amount of money you lent Greece, but would make it palatable and manageable. Drastic cuts in tax rates in order to re-energize the Greek economy, a development bank that would work together with KfW and with the European Investment Bank, and a bad bank by which to deal with the non-performing loans. Basic things. You know, this is. I remember when I was talking to Jack Lew, the U.S. Secretary General, he said to me, U.S. Treasury Secretary, he said to me, well, this sounds like something a Wall Street banker would come up with. And yet that was dismissed, was never discussed. And what did we have instead? 25th of June, we had a document from the Troika that was asking me to sign up on taking more tens of billions from you under the condition of what? Increasing tax rates in a broken economy. And I said, no, because I'm not going to sign up on any loan agreement which gives me more money from you folks when I have no doubt that this will not be payable. And I asked Lagarde, Draghi, Schäuble in that meeting and in private, do you think this would work if I signed it? Is it possible, not probable, possible, that it can work and we can repay this money? And all three of them said no. All three of them said no. And yet, the media was reporting that I was refusing to cooperate because I'm an anti-Europeanist, populist, left-wing, communist, whatever. Now, when you get to that point, you know that there's something profoundly wrong with Europe. Allow me to read something that I said on the 8th of June when I was about to meet Wolfgang Schäuble. The day before, I gave a speech in Berlin to a very large audience. And I had this to say. Allow me to read it out to you. Speaking about Europe in general, clearly we need political union. What type? Let us not forget that the Soviet Union was also a political union, albeit not one we wish to emulate. What Europe must aim for is a democratic political union that will appeal to Europeans. Europeans must ask ourselves an important question. Do we want a liberal political union that engages with those like myself, who are critical of the current European Union policies, but committed to the European Union? Or do we want a political union that has no tolerance for dissent against failed policies, and which tries to snuff out inconvenient pro-Europeans like us and my government at the expense of European democracy. Permit me to guess, this is 8th June 2015, that if Europe opts for the latter, it will end up being dominated by anti-Europeans who hate Europe and all it stands for, and who want to drag Europe back towards the nationalistic nativism that has caused so much human loss for so many centuries. The following morning, I walked into Wolfgang Schäuble's office. We spoke for 2.5 hours. I'm not going to tell you what we said. I was putting forward my proposal. He was pressurizing me to sign on the dotted line of this terrible extend and pretend loan agreement. At some point, the only thing I need to tell you is this. After he had confessed to me that he in my place would not have signed it, but he was still pushing me to sign it. Yeah? I will only describe to you the feeling that we had. Outside that room, we were being portrayed as the finance minister, the elderly statesman of the most powerful European country, and the recalcitrant, time-wasting, gambling, left-wing minister of a bankrupt Greece, fighting it out. I'll tell you what was really going on in there. Towards the end, the last half hour of our meeting, after we tried to discuss what we could do, let me just add to this, that we were in agreement that that which was going to happen would simply not work and would be tragic for my people and bad for Germany and bad for Europeans. The last half hour, ladies and gentlemen, we spent as two broken, disillusioned, powerless men who didn't have any kind of confidence that our Chancellor or Prime Minister, that the rest of the European Union would allow us to do that which we both knew would be much better than what we had. We didn't agree on that, exactly what that should be, but we agreed that what was going to happen was completely and totally wrong. So I'm only conveying this to you to help you understand that Europe is in major difficulty because the true goings on, the true powerlessness of even the most powerful of ministers in Europe is shielded from your eyes. And while this is happening, the only beneficiaries are the Donald Trumps of Europe. In Germany, in Greece, in France, in Hungary, everywhere. So let me finish with the following. What we need is a speech of hope for Europe. Secretary Burns in 1946 came to Stuttgart and delivered it to the German people. We need a similar speech to be delivered by Angela Merkel. I do not know where she will choose to deliver it. Maybe she will deliver it in Greece. Maybe she will deliver it in Spain. Maybe she will deliver it in Berlin. I really don't care. But it must be a radical speech of hope. She must seize the last opportunity she has to do that which she has refused to do since 2010. To signal that there is an alternative to the radical, belligerent nationalism which is now gaining the upper hand. That she can say, as she said magnificently in the autumn of 2015, that Europe is about being borderless, that we are going to do our duty to the refugees. We are not going to succumb to electrified fences between our countries. We are not going to turn Syrian refugees back to President Erdogan on the basis of a very cynical attempt to renounce our own responsibilities to international legislation. That we are going to simulate a federation. We can't have a federation tomorrow. But technically, we can simulate a federation in the realms of public debt, banking, investment policy for the whole of Europe, and the social economy. And that she is going to lead that with a narrative that it is as radical as that of the Alternative for Deutschland, of the people of Golden Dawn, of Marine Le Pen and Donald Trump, except that instead of peddling, fear, loathing, anger, and angst, as they do, we Europeans are going to be peddling hope and rationality. And when people say to me, yes, but is it in her interest to do this? Is it in the interest of the French government to accept something like that? The Italian government? I am going to invoke one of the greatest thinkers that Europe has produced, Immanuel Kant, one of your own, who made it so beautifully clear that the majesty of duty has and should have nothing to do with the expedience of calculation. Thank you very much.